The system that's normally entangled in scandal has a couple of highlights to report. We'll talk about Texas foster care today on The Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group, software delivered as promised. No surprises.
What happens when the University Interscholastic League tweaks its guidelines? We look at three major implications. What Texas is willing to do when it comes to vaping and e-cigarettes. We'll tell you more. It looks like the stuff of action films, buried walls that come out to shield a building from floods. That's happening in Houston. A new LGBTQ task force, the week in politics, and poetry for the soul. All that and more. This is the Texas Standard. There's a bit of good news coming out of Texas foster care, and I thought you should hear it. Welcome. This is the Texas Standard. I'm Joy Diaz in for David Brown on this beautiful Friday, December the 6th. More children left foster care in fiscal year 2019 than entered the system. Truly, Texas foster care could use this bit of good news. For years, the agency has struggled with internal challenges. Huge caseloads managed by underpaid caseworkers, lack of homes for emergency placements, placing children in offices where they were left overnight, allegations of sexual abuse. Some children even died while in the system. Cases going all the way to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. But back to the good news, those numbers, more kids leaving foster care. For that, we're joined by Bob Garrett, Austin Bureau Chief for the Dallas Morning News. Bob, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Joy.
So please guide me with these numbers. I don't understand this very well. We have 20,000 kids who left the system, but only 6,100 were adopted. That means not even a third of them were adopted. So where did all the kids go?
Well, a lot of them are still in the system. I think at any given time, we have 11,000 in sort of long-term foster care. A lot of them are going into kinship placements with grandmothers and grandparents or other relatives. So I think there's a lot of moving parts to these numbers, but I guess the good news that the state is touting is that the number being adopted is at a record over 6,100 for last year.
I wanted to ask you about that it hit a record high in adoptions, and more than half of those adoptions were relatives, what we call kinship care. That's a first, but there's been a big emphasis. What's the benefit of placing children with relatives?
Well, the biggest benefit is they get to stay in their home community, go to the same schools in most cases, don't get that even greater disruption of their lives that happens if they are sent a long way away from home for a foster care placement. One point is that there's caregivers or relative kinship caregivers adopting, and then there are those that are taking kids just without a permanent adoption. So
right.
there's a lot of different programs going on here, but the big benefit of being placed with a relative is not going to a stranger, not going far away.
I wonder if that's one of the reasons why we're seeing these numbers being so high, that it's been a push for a while.
It has been a push for a while, and there have been a slow accretion of both federal and state financial carrots to help persuade grandma to take in little Johnny and Susie. And so these things have been gaining momentum, and there's been more state focus on them, more money to help someone that, say, is a low-income, fixed-income senior grandparent to sort of get over the hump and say, yeah, I can do this. I can, with this little extra money, I can provide for these grandchildren of mine.
Another thing that is fascinating about the numbers, I think, is that there's fewer child abuse reports and there's fewer number of confirmed cases of abuse, which means there's fewer number of children entering the foster care system. I wonder, what do you attribute this to?
Well, the anomalies in reporting are always hard to know. We have certain mandatory reporters like teachers and ministers and counselors have to report to CPS. The general public, we aren't under that same legal obligation to report suspicions. I don't know, Joy, honestly,
yeah,
how to explain a drop in that, because we have an expanding state population. Those reporting numbers are just really hard to get behind the true reasons.
And still, we have 30,000 kids in care. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about what's happening at the legislature regarding foster care.
What's happening at the legislature is we've had a big problem of shortages of the beds where we need them geographically. And the legislature is pursuing a sort of hyper-privatization model called community-based care that puts a private contractor, generally speaking, in charge of a region, and they, rather than the state, are in charge of building up the capacity and signing contracts and developing foster homes. But the state legislature is not really showing signs of getting ready for the biggest change in federal funding of foster care in 40 years. That one is looming for the next session, and that has huge implications for Texas, because we could be losing federal foster care money if we don't get ready and put more, have a strategy to put more of the money into prevention. And also, if we're going to keep kids in large group settings, they have to be accredited and have all these services that are not now provided. So that's the big obstacle that faces the legislature looking ahead.
Wow, lots to come. Bob Garrett is Austin Bureau Chief for the Dallas Morning News. Bob, thank you so much for being on The Standard today.
Thanks for having me join.
Support for Coverage of Business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping companies protect their drivers on the road. More at worksafetexas.com/onthejob.
Severe lung disease cases linked to vaping across Texas have surpassed 200. That's what the state health department reported earlier this week. One person has died, and these are young people, on average 22 years old, and we really don't know much about which vaping products are causing these illnesses. Texas Health and Human Services says 9 in 10 of these patients reported vaping THC or marijuana, but the department is urging Texans not to use any e-cigarette products. And just yesterday, the CDC released a report saying more than 6 million American teens said they used tobacco products in 2019, with e-cigarettes being the most common. Texas senators on the State Health Committee met this week to raise concerns about these reports. And Republican Senator Charles Perry of Lubbock joins us today. He's the vice chairman of the State Health and Human Services Committee. Senator Perry, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Yeah, it's good to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
What's your reaction to the state health report on these severe lung diseases related to vaping products?
Well, there's so many reactions that are appropriate. First of all, individuals need to understand that when you knowingly participate in and consuming a product, in this case, inhaling, that has shown the potential to, one, to lead to addiction because of the nicotine content, and two, because of the black market and some of the aftermarket stuff that's being added to it that could kill you, personal responsibility interjects into that conversation somewhere at a very deep level. Mm. And we can't legislate that. We can't make laws to make people be responsible and make responsible decisions. That said, we do have a situation now where the product that people are consuming are possibly going to kill them because of some of the ingredients being added. So, as always, this society looks to government to fix personal irresponsibility, lack of parenting when it comes to minor children, and that's where it's laid at the doorstep of the Texas Senate.
You touched on the fact that some of these people are very young and that it's parental and government responsibility to take care of our children. So what legislation could come out of Texas that would address these reports?
Well, I would qualify. It's parents that are responsible for their children. Unfortunately, in today's world, government seems to be a surrogate or a substitute parent. The Texas legislature, you know, is going to probably do several things. They're going to look at the statistics and the data and support and see if we can identify the specific bad actors, if you will. I think anybody that perpetuates an addiction, be it nicotine or otherwise, is considered a bad actor. I made that clear in the hearing. But FDA is currently reviewing these. So if these aftermarket products that are being added are proved to be detrimental to the health, and I think they will be, the acetate and some of the other things, then you're going to see lawsuits, I think, and litigation pursue. Just no different than the tobacco industry that happened a few years back. You'll see strong consideration by the Texas legislature to treat the vaping industry no different than the tobacco industry. The common theme being there, it's addictive and it's based on an addiction on nicotine that's purposely added to products to create that addiction.
What would it take for you personally to support a ban on all vaping products? I know you've made it clear that, you know, you want people to take personal responsibility, but what would it take from you to support a ban until we know more, until we know what exactly is causing these illnesses?
Until the industry steps up and pays for all of the remedies that were suggested in the hearing the other day, from education to incarceration to judicial action on people that violate the MIPs was a term, minors in possession, until they're willing to write the check for all of those social state costs to deal with these social ills, then I'm going to be a staunch advocate of not having it. Because as a state, as a federal government, as all of the government entities are challenged to deal with these social issues of the day regarding irresponsible use or irresponsible industry proposing products that can do harm, we're picking those costs up through increased insurance premiums, medical cost, ER cost, long-term health cost that end up costing all of the citizens, including the state governments that help take money from those citizens to satisfy these needs. I'm going to be pretty much a strong advocate against it.
Charles Perry is a Republican senator from Lubbock and vice chairman of the Senate Health and Human Services Committee. Senator Perry, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We reached out to the American Vaping Association. Its response? When it comes to recent lung illnesses and deaths, the evidence continues to point to contaminated illicit THC products as a cause. There should be more done to prevent youth experimentation with vaping, but that does not mean we should take away options from American adults who still smoke cigarettes, and banning flavors won't do a thing to stop risk-seeking youth from experimenting. Social media editor Wells Dunbar, what are you hearing?
Hi, Laura. I almost called you Laura there. Hi, Joy.
Seriously.
Lots of folks chiming in about this vaping conversation. You know, there's two big aspects to it. This part about the lung injuries and even the death that we've seen here in Texas, yeah. Plus this question of addiction. Folks chiming in on both aspects. Janice Hitchcock on our Facebook page says that legalization of marijuana and regulation of the market could fix this issue. Instead, Janice predicts that politicians will spend their time railing against what she calls demon weed and pretending to protect children. Meanwhile, Johnny Billet says, I imagine there's a lot of money from the tobacco lobby pushing the narrative that vaping is a huge, scary new threat. He says, I would not be surprised to learn that the tobacco lobby is weaponizing this public outcry
really? And
regulation to strangle vape companies. Meanwhile, Jason Chang has his own recommendation. He says, tax, test, regulate, and put vape detectors in school with the new revenue. I wonder if such a thing could be possible. Interesting questions and comments there from all of our listeners.
There's so much to unpack. I'd love for, you know, for us to hear more from our listeners. Before you come back, Wells.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with small and mid-sized companies by helping to unify their businesses and achieve digital transformation. More at randgroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm Joy Diaz. The Brownsville City Commission has approved the creation of a task force that will give the LGBTQ community a voice in addressing discrimination, health concerns, and other related issues in this border city. Texas Public Radio's Reynaldo Leaños Jr. reports.
Joe Colonu-Vayez is a local activist. He's prepared to speak with the city commissioners and mayor about creating the new group. The room is packed. Several people stand along the wall. Colonu-Vayez starts to walk to the podium.
I ask you to vote yes in favor of the task force to help bring our community to the table to begin addressing homophobia, discrimination, and other concerns impacting citizens that should require the involvement of the city to help advise on policy and work that supports the needs of an increasingly visible community.
Albert Hinojosa, another local resident, speaks after Colonu-Vayez. He said it was important to be there because he wants to prevent others from the LGBTQ community from being harassed like he was several months earlier by an employee at a local restaurant.
This gentleman right away thought I didn't know how to speak Spanish, so he insulted me by a homophobic word. And so I let him know, hey, I understood what you said.
Hinojosa was having dinner with his family, including his 15-year-old niece and 6-year-old nephew.
But I was like, okay, it's normal. They always say that. But then they started to cry and freak out. Like, that's not normal. So and then I was like, you know, I was used to just numbing myself to things like that. But it's not fair.
Hinojosa says the restaurant's manager got involved. The police eventually showed up and a police report was filed, but nothing was done. Jessica Tetro Khalifa is the city commissioner for District 2. Hinojosa is her hairstylist. She says she remembers seeing the pain he went through after the incident at the restaurant. It reminded her of Texas's stance on rights for the LGBTQ community.
We live in a state that doesn't support rights. It doesn't support anything. And there were no laws. There were no ordinances to protect him from what happened. And I remember thinking, this is something so wrong. Why isn't anybody doing anything? And so shortly after that, I said, this has to change.
Back at the city commissioners meeting, the room hears from more LGBTQ community members. Then Tetro Khalifa makes a motion among the commissioners to approve the task force. Mayor Trey Mendez puts it to a vote.
Those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Motion passes.
After the meeting, Colon Uvias and others celebrated. He says he's overwhelmed with happiness to see Brownsville join cities like Austin, San Antonio, Dallas, and Houston, which have similar LGBTQ advisory boards.
It's now up to other cities in the Valley to look towards Brownsville as an example of how to be more inclusive and create opportunities for these conversations and for these kind of committees to exist. Yeah, we're making history, and, you know, this is just the beginning of that history.
Mayor Mendez said the next steps are figuring out how many members will be part of the task force and setting its goals. I'm Reynaldo Leaños Jr. in Brownsville.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping companies protect their drivers on the road. More at worksafetexas.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Allison, Harvey, Imelda, these are just a few of the tropical storms that have left Houston in wreck since the turn of the century. And as these once-in-a-while storms start occurring more and more frequently, institutions are slowly starting to prepare. One high school in northern Houston is getting flood control assistance from the Federal Emergency Management Agency. We also call it FEMA. FEMA is paying $25 million to help build floodgates for a school. And I wonder how these will work. So Shelby Webb is here to help us with that. She's an education reporter for the Houston Chronicle. Shelby, thank you so much for speaking to us.
Thanks for having me.
Tell me a little bit about the school, Kingwood High School.
Sure. Well, Kingwood High is located in Humble ISD, as you said, in the Northeast Houston area, and it has been absolutely wrecked by some of the more recent storms that we had. It took on 5 feet of floodwaters during Tropical Storm Harvey. Tropical Storm Imelda more recently this year flooded the building's gym and other classrooms that are still inaccessible to students. And, you know, more and more frequently, as we have more of these rain events, students at that school are wondering, well, is the school going to flood again? Are we going to have to go somewhere else? Or what's the district going to do?
So what's the idea to put floodgates, and what? How would they work?
So the floodgate, there's a couple different ways to do floodgates. The one that Kingwood High is looking at right now are buried beneath the ground. And as floodwaters come in, they go into these little, I guess, sort of gaps that surround the buried floodgates. And the water that goes in there will cause the gates to float up. And at their tallest, they will be 8 feet tall in some of the lowest lying parts of the campus. And so they'll rise sort of with the level of the water.
It sounds very 007, if you are asking me. I mean, just imagining these huge sort of walls rising as the water rises.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, they'll be invisible to students for
right.
The vast majority of the year. But, you know, when push comes to shove, I'm sure it'll be quite a sight to see.
And it's been done before, or at least something similar has been done before in Houston, right?
Right. And so two of our biggest institutions, the University of Houston and the Texas Medical Center, are protected by floodgates right now. I talked to folks over at the University of Houston who got the floodgates after Hurricane Allison damaged, I think, something like 90 of their 105 buildings at the time.
Wow.
And they said in Harvey, you know, compared to Allison, where they had 12 feet of water in some of their buildings, only one of their buildings in Harvey got a few inches of floodwaters, and that was because a pump failed. But almost all of their buildings stayed dry. I mean, there was some seepage, and you know, folks told me that's to be expected. But the Texas Medical Center as well weathered Harvey pretty well because of the floodgates they had. Whereas in Allison, decades worth of research, patient records, almost everything that was in the basements and some of the first floors were just totally destroyed.
Well, we know it works. And, you know, Shelby, I was wondering, I mean, we cannot predict when these events will, at least not the time of day, when these events will happen. And one of the things that FEMA stresses when you are floodproofing a building is, you know, to occupant safety. And I was wondering, if the kids are inside, as the floodgates rise, will they effectively be trapped in the building?
That scenario played out across Houston during Imelda this year. I mean, there were kids in school districts across the area who were stuck on their campuses because the waters rose so high in the streets that buses, parents, and others couldn't get to the kids on the campuses. So, I mean, I think some in Aldine ISD were stuck at their schools until about 9 or 10 p.m. that night.
Wow. Now, tell me about the $25 million. How did Kingwood get this money?
So they worked with FEMA. FEMA has a special program that just works specifically for protecting buildings and institutions from flooding, that especially buildings that have flooded before. And so the sort of threshold that they look for is, you know, will this project cost less than half of what it cost us to fix your building in the past?
Interesting.
And it cost about $63 million to fix Kingwood High after Hurricane Harvey. And because this came in under about $30 million, they went ahead and said, we'll pay for 90% of the cost of putting in these floodgates, sort of hoping to get a good return on investment in case there's a future storm.
Shelby Webb is following the full story for the Houston Chronicle. Check it out. Shelby, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you. Support for Texas Standard comes from Abilene Christian University, focusing on student success within key areas like service learning, first-year experiences, and learning communities. More at acu.edu.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. State senators are looking at how to make infrastructure throughout Texas more resilient to flooding and other natural disasters. It's one of the interim charges Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick asked them to work on ahead of the next legislative session in 2021. Nim Kidd is with the Texas Division of Emergency Management. He told lawmakers during a hearing Thursday that currently local officials can request funds for mitigation projects from up to five different state agencies. Kidd wants to streamline that process by teaming up with the General Land Office and the Texas Water Development Board.
We agreed in principle to create a one-stop shop for our local government partners. It's a compact, if you will. Each one of us retains our own grant programs, our own responsibility, but we've committed that our staffs will work together, hand in glove, so that there is one place in Texas for a local official to come to and ask for mitigation project funding.
Kidd said the agencies made that agreement earlier this week. Texas went into this year with a historically tight electricity supply, raising concerns there could be rolling blackouts, but that did not happen. And as KUT's Mose Bouchel reports, electric grid operators expect the state to have even more breathing room next year.
It comes down to something called the electricity reserve margin. That's the amount of power that generators can produce beyond peak demand. Put another way, it's the wiggle room of extra electricity that helps ensure we don't get blackouts. And it looks like it'll grow by 2% next year. The Electric Reliability Council of Texas is the group that operates the grid. It says that increase is thanks to solar and wind farms expected to come online, along with gas plants. ERCOT says it's also improved its ability to forecast how much renewable energy it can expect. While ERCOT estimates next year's reserve margin to be bigger, it's still pretty tight compared to what most U.S. grid operators work with. But the report says it will continue to grow in 2021 thanks to a boom in solar power generation.
KUT's Mose Bouchel reporting. The Texas Alcoholic Beverage Commission expects third-party companies will be making alcohol home deliveries before the new year. The agency is now accepting permit applications for the service as part of a new law the state legislature passed last spring. TABC's Chris Porter says regulators worked for months with industry stakeholders to determine fees and training requirements.
It allows those third-party businesses such as Instacart or Favor to go and pick up the alcohol from the retailers and then deliver it on their behalf to consumers. It gives the retailers a little more flexibility in how they get the products to the consumers.
TABC plans to begin issuing the permits in the third week of December. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, working to strengthen public education for all students. More information at raiseyourhandtexas.org. The future of Texas is in our public schools. Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping companies protect their drivers on the road. More at worksafetexas.com/onthejob.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm Joy Diaz in for David Brown. One state is synonymous with capital punishment, and I bet you know which one I'm talking about. Texas has carried out more than 550 executions since 1976. That was the year when a court ruling affirmed the legality of the death penalty. More than four decades into the death penalty's modern era, Texas still leads the nation in executions, and moreover, Texas reflects trends across the U.S. in the application of capital punishment. For instance, how it's used in fewer instances overall, but definitely used more against minorities. It's a lot to take in. So here to put all this into context is Liliana Segura. She and her reporting partner, Jordan Smith, recently published an exhaustive four-part look at the death penalty for the investigative website The Intercept. Liliana, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with the idea behind the series. What was it that you wanted to accomplish?
So it really dates back to 2016. It was the 40-year anniversary of the landmark decision that kind of is known for ushering in what we know to be the so-called modern death penalty era. Mm-hmm. To give you a little bit of historical context, in 1972, the U.S. Supreme Court decided in a case called Furman versus Georgia that the death penalty as practiced in the United States was unconstitutional. And immediately states set about kind of correcting their laws. In a matter of just 4 years, the issue returned to the Supreme Court. And in 1976, the U.S. Supreme Court handed down Gregg versus Georgia, along with another couple of rulings, including a ruling out of Texas, and sort of signaled the end of a kind of de facto moratorium and the beginning of the new era in which states could once again resume executions.
And it is that ruling out of Texas, the Jurek versus Texas, that you say was, if not equally important, perhaps even more important than Gregg versus Georgia. Why is that?
When you look at the impact over the subsequent 40 plus years, it's been enormous. You know, Texas is the death penalty capital of the country, of the world, really, in many ways. It contained three questions that were posed to jurors. The first one was whether the crime had been committed, quote, deliberately and with the expectation that the victim would die. The second question was whether there was a probability that the defendant would commit criminal acts of violence that would constitute a continuing threat to society. And the third one was whether the killing was, quote, unreasonable in response to any provocation by the victim. If the jurors, if they unanimously answered yes to all three questions, then there would be an automatic death sentence. And that's what kind of greased the wheels of the death penalty from that early stage. And, you know, it took a little while for executions to resume in Texas, but they did in 1982. And as we know, Texas really hasn't stopped.
Liliana, there's a line in your story that reads, race has always been at the heart of the American death penalty. Do you have data to support this statement?
The line that you can see the most clearly is in lynchings when it came to, mm-hmm. you know, the era after Reconstruction, the sort of backlash to the end of slavery. Brian Stevenson from the Equal Justice Initiative calls the death penalty the stepchild of lynching. And the reason for that is that people who were lynched were often accused of some kind of sexual impropriety or sexual violence against a white woman. At the very point, sort of historically, where you start to see a decline in lynchings is where you start to see a rise in both legislation authorizing and just the death penalty in a sort of more state-sanctioned way. When Justice Thurgood Marshall handed down his concurrence in the Furman case, he noted explicitly that out of 455 people who'd been executed in the United States for rape since, I think, 1930, 405 had been Black. Mm-hmm. So this kind of legacy really haunts the death penalty, not just in Texas, but in all southern states and throughout the country.
There's also an underreported aspect of the death penalty that you focused on, and it talks about how there's a vast number of people who were originally sentenced to die, but they are no longer on death row. And because I've reported on death row, I was thinking, well, some of them die of natural causes, but I wonder if you have other reasons of what happened to some of these people.
Oh, yeah. I mean, out of the roughly 7,335, you know, death sentences sort of in our data set, we found 2,373 people had been resentenced. There were also, you know, more than 300 people released from prison. And there was a journalist who went and did research some years ago trying to track down what happened to those folks. And what she found was that, yeah, there was a handful of men who went on to commit new crimes of violence, but the majority did not. It kind of puts the lie to this claim that these are people so dangerous that they have to be put to death in execution chambers throughout the country.
Liliana Segura is a reporter with The Intercept, and her latest is a four-part package on the death penalty called The Condemned. Liliana, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Tuition Promise Fund. For over 10 years, helping families lock in current tuition rates and required fees at Texas public colleges and universities, excluding medical and dental institutions. TexasTuitionPromiseFund.com.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm Joy Diaz. In Texas, public schools are sorted by size for extracurricular competitions, which means big schools play big schools and little schools play little schools. But this week, the UIL, the University Interscholastic League, released new guidelines for how the schools are divided up. This happens every 2 years, and it's a bigger deal for some schools than it is for others. In fact, for small schools, it could mean playing an entirely different sport. The Texas Standard's Michael Marks reports.
Don't feel bad if you're not overly familiar with six-man football. Israel DeLeon doesn't know a ton about it either.
I have zero six-man experience. My staff has zero six-man experience. Never coached it, never played it, and the honest truth is I've never watched a six-man football game.
That's going to change in a hurry, though, because as of now, DeLeon is in charge of a six-man football program. He's the head football coach and athletic director at Spring Lake Earth High School, a panhandle school of about 90 students. DeLeon has coached there for 6 years. He's an alumnus, too, played linebacker and fullback in the 90s. The school has always played 11-man ball, but over the past few years, as its population dwindled, DeLeon's had fewer and fewer players for the football team. Eventually, it became clear that Spring Lake Earth just wouldn't have enough players to field an 11-man team.
It's a small community, and it's not growing. It's not something that anybody wanted to do. It's just something we had to do.
The numbers the UIL released earlier this week confirmed that. The school fell below the 11-man threshold. Instead, they'll play six-man, a much different game. Of the 1,200 or so high schools in Texas that play football, only about 150 play six-man. Six-man football obviously requires fewer players, but it's also faster than its traditional cousin. It's described as basketball on grass. The field is a bit smaller, but there are fewer blockers, more space, more laterals, more opportunities for chaos. DeLeon's already found, though, that the learning curve is steep.
It's going to be hard for me. I've watched, hours and hours of six-man games and just trying to find offensive concepts that kind of correlate to what we do and what we kind of hang our hat on.
But this is the situation that a handful of schools find themselves in every few years when the UIL redivides its schools. And it goes both ways. Sometimes schools move up to 11-man, too. On the Bolivar Peninsula, 35 miles northeast of Galveston, High Island High School used to play 11-man. But in 2008, Hurricane Ike hit. Students left, and the school opted to play 6-man instead. But that presents its own problems, though.
Usually we leave here about 7:38 in the morning, get home around midnight.
That's Matt Miracle, head football coach at High Island, describing his team's schedule for away games. They usually play on Saturdays. There's just not enough time on Friday nights because the closest 6-man schools are around 5 hours away. All that travel requires a lot of time and money. So even though the competition may be stiffer against 11-man teams, doing so would improve travel time and expenses. So Miracle applied for a waiver to return to it.
Whatever we do, we want to make sure whatever decision is ultimately reached, we want to do what's best for kids.
This is the kind of choice that small schools have to face that other schools just don't. It's not an easy one, either. At Spring Lake Earth, DeLeon said that some people in the community look down their noses at 6-man. But now that they're there, he said, they might as well try to win. For the Texas Standard, I'm Michael Marks.
And of course, football is just one of the many activities some schools have. There's volleyball, baseball, softball, debate, theater competitions. All those are affected by the UIL realignment too. Joining us now to tell us more is Alexis Cubitt, who covers high school sports for the Lubbock Avalanche Journal. Alexis, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you for having me. This is my first radio interview, so I'm very excited.
I'm so glad. What's your sense about realignment, Alexis? Is it something schools are dreading?
Yes and no. I think just figuring out the districts and stuff, I think it is something that they are concerned about just because of travel and, you know, cost expenses with those traveling. And the fact of the matter is Texas is a huge state.
Right.
And so when you look at, you know, okay, well, how can we make this as convenient as possible for all parties involved? It can be a real challenge.
The way it's looking right now, we have schools in Amarillo that could be playing schools in Isleta, and that's over 300 miles away.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And that's one of the big things. There's a lot of rumors kind of floating around all over the place. That's one of them. One of them is that there would be Amarillo schools by themselves. Another one is that it would be, I think Abilene schools are trying to get east to like the Fort Worth area. And so it just pretty much kind of a mess, honestly, of just trying to figure out, you know, how to do that. But yeah, that's a big concern is that, you know, okay, well, how do we take these kids that have to get their education? Obviously, you put that first. But then we have to travel so far. And so one of the ideas proposed that I heard of was playing on Saturdays, which that has its own consequences because you figure, I mean, these kids, yes, they play for the love of the sport, but a lot of them want to go on to play college. How can you get recruited, you know, and coaches come to watch your game on a Saturday if that's when college games are? And so it's, you know, a thing that I do not envy the UIL at all of trying to figure all of this out. But at the end of the day, it's not everybody's going to be happy with it. And I think travel is something that should be the biggest consideration, other than, of course, the actual numbers. But yeah, that travel thing is going to get real tricky.
One of the things that I was reading is that the transportation will need to be chartered. Is that because of the distances?
Yes, that's the big thing because, I mean, for example, our area teams here, Coronado and Monterey, both had to play in El Paso. Mm-hmm. And so they had to charter to get the bus, or they had to take a charter bus, but also they had to spend the night because of how long it is.
Right.
You know, Monterey in particular had to spend the night because they played at noon on Saturday. I mean, that would literally be traveling at night. So they went ahead and spent the night in El Paso. Coronado, I believe, kind of did a turnaround trip, but they left in the afternoon on, I think it was Friday or early Saturday morning, and then got back at like 6 o'clock in the morning on Sunday. So those are kind of the things that you'd hope the UIL is factoring in and looking at as far as that goes.
Long drives, money. What about tradition? Because some teams are used to playing each other. There's sort of like this cultural thing that has built up over the years.
Right. You do kind of factor into that. For the most part, from what I can tell so far, there aren't really any rivalries that will be affected right now, except for maybe with Tascosa. Tascosa is a 6A, and they've been moved down to 5A division one, which is crazy because they're still playing. They're playing for, I think it's the regional finals this weekend in 6A. So you figure they're this dominant at the biggest level, and now they're coming down.
Well, we're eager to learn more. Alexis Cubitt is a high school sports reporter for the Lubbock Avalanche Journal. Thank you so much for joining us, Alexis.
Yeah, absolutely, and thank you for having me.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with SAP to help mid-sized companies streamline operations such as CRM, finance, and procurement. More at randgroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises. Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. Families can save for tuition, room and board, books, and other qualified education expenses at eligible schools nationwide. Learn more at texascollegesavings.com.
I'm Sean Petrie. I'm with the Typewriter Rodeo. In the Typewriter Rodeo, we make up poems on the spot on whatever topic people want. Construction. It's making my files even more of a mess. That nonstop jackhammer shaking my desk. Across the street, another condo goes up while I watch my coffee jiggle in my cup. I know that progress must always keep improving. But does it also mean my floor is always moving? That nonstop construction is like a pounding in my brain, the rumbling of the trucks, the screeching of that crane. Ah, finally, the pace has gone slower. And now, are you kidding me? Who's got that leaf blower?
For the Texas Standard, I'm Sean Petrie with the Typewriter Rodeo.
Support for the Typewriter Rodeo comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org.
That poem, of course, comes to us from our friends at Typewriter Rodeo. Got an idea for a topic? Let us know. Send us your requests on social media or email us, texasstandard@kut.org. Time to turn to politics on this Friday. Here to talk about the week that was is Alex Samuels, political reporter for the Texas Tribune. Alex, welcome back to the Texas Standard. How are you?
Good, good.
I'm so happy you're here. Let's start with State Representative Rick Miller, the Republican from Sugar Land, announcing that he won't seek re-election. Tell us what happened.
So on Monday night, in a widely circulated interview with the Houston Chronicle, Rick Miller made the comments that two of his Republican opponents, former Fort Bend GOP chairman J.C. Jeton and Houston Fire Department analyst Leonard Chan, likely joined the race because they're Asian in a district with a sizable Asian population. By Tuesday morning, the backlash was pretty swift. Governor Greg Abbott had pulled his endorsement of Miller, and the Fort Bend County GOP chair had also denounced Miller's remarks. And by Friday afternoon, Rick Miller said he would no longer be running for re-election in 2020.
One thing that amazed me, not only his remarks, of course, and not only that that some people reacted to them, but how swiftly they reacted. That was amazing.
Right. And I think that caught a lot of folks by surprise. Even the Fort Bend County GOP chairwoman was telling us that it surprised her just how quickly everything happened. And the Tribune followed up with Leonard Chan the morning after everything happened. And he wasn't even in Texas. He's in Boston for work. But he said that he just hadn't had time to process everything. He was so surprised at how
quickly Miller's downfall seemed to come after those initial remarks to the Chronicle.
Yeah. You wrote this week about the surge that one Democratic presidential candidate has had, Mayor Pete Buttigieg of South Bend, Indiana. And you talk about how he has a big champion here in Texas. Who are you talking about?
Yeah, so Austin Mayor Steve Adler and Pete Buttigieg go back way before the 2020 elections. So the two of them have known each other now for almost 5 years, just that bond of being mayors of sizable towns. And Adler has really turned into one of Buttigieg's biggest champions here in Texas.
And this week, changing topics drastically, more protests at the University of Texas at Austin over the school's handling of sexual misconduct cases. I think in part is that case of the school reinstating two professors. Tell us what's the latest.
Right. So students at the University of Texas at Austin have stormed classrooms and staged sit-ins over basically the university's handling of two professors who have been punished for sexual misconduct. A big thing that has really upset the students, they told some of our reporters, is that they were finding out about these misconduct cases often through Twitter or through friends rather than the university themselves. And since UT students have expressed, you know, their displeasure with the university's handling of this, I know UT President Greg Femvis and the Executive Vice President and Provost have agreed to attend public forums with students next semesters, and administrators have met with student organizers several times. So I think we're still seeing how the university will handle these cases going forward.
Alex Samuels with the Texas Tribune. Thank you so much.
Yes, of course. Thank you for having me.
And you're listening to the Texas Standard. Social media editor Wells Dunbar, we had so many topics today that you're hearing from Texans.
We sure did, you know. And I got to say, this first topic, I think we talked about this maybe a little earlier in the week, but it was too good not to let it go by unmentioned here. The redheaded stranger, one Willie Nelson, you heard this one? He says he no longer smokes marijuana.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Willie's reserved. He's got his own strain and everything, but that doesn't mean that he's given up completely on imbibing THC. It's just that the 86-year-old troubadour doesn't feel that smoke is the best thing for his lungs anymore.
Well, or ever.
Or ever, yes, that's true. But this comes in remarks he made to San Antonio ABC affiliate KSAT. You know, he'd had this string of, like, canceled concert dates. Yeah. There was, like, some talk about respiratory troubles. But he said he's basically, I've abused my lungs long enough, doing that anymore. So it's the end of an era, perhaps, but plenty of people are chiming in with what the news means. Christopher Waters on our Facebook page says, it's not like we'll forget about the legendary country musician from Texas that smoked a joint with Jimmy Carter's son on the White House roof in the 1970s. Willie's got to do what Willie's got to do. And I looked that one up. I think that really did happen per President Carter's son there. Meanwhile, Morgan Hamilton says, I'm glad that he's looking after his health because the longer he's around, the better. And
it is true.
Yeah. And we should add, you know, that, you know, he does have his own strain of marijuana that includes edibles and includes vaporizers. So I'm sure the guy's not wanting for, you know, whatever recreational.
No need to inhale. Okay.
Yeah, things he may need there. Hey, shifting gears here. Did you see Alexa's tweet this week?
Yes, I did. And you know what? I am so envious because I am terrible at Twitter.
Well, you know, you're not terrible at Twitter.
It is an art.
Secondly, we don't always knock them out of the park like this, but our own Alexandra Hart sure did, producer on the show. She's Twitter famous now after a tweet from her took off, garnering, 2,500 replies and 5,600 likes.
Oh, my goodness.
And I guess it's really all about playing to what you know, or the audience, rather, on Twitter, because her topic that she put up here for News Savvy Twitter was one that we all know a lot about, cliches in journalism. Present company excluded. But Alexa wrote, what are some dumb phrases that journalists love but nobody uses in real life? She started with new lease on life.
Uh-huh.
We also heard probe.
What's yours, Will?
Fracas. You know, mine was officer involved.
Ah.
Whoever, you know, that is, you only hear that from the police and from folks, but lots of fun responses going on there. So we've retweeted it. It's at the top of our Twitter feed right now. So go check it out. A lot of fun stuff there.
Write to us, tweet at us, whatever you want to do. This is the Texas Standard. Happy trails to you until we meet again.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Waldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington family. Would your company or organization like to be a sponsor as well? Contact your local station for opportunities within your community. For statewide sponsorships, visit TexasPublicMediaNetwork.com.